If you have the chance to work with editor Robert Gottlieb, here's some advice. Be careful about using the L word, legend. Is one of the most successful editors in the history of publishing intimidating?
I think of myself as a guy who lucked into a wonderful job and was good enough at it to be successful, but I do not see myself as a legend. Obviously, only an idiot would. I couldn't imagine anyone being afraid of me. Why would anybody be afraid of me? But there it was. But he got over it.
You might get a different answer from some of the many authors Robert Gottlieb has worked with in his more than 60 years as a book editor. He helped give birth to such classics as Catch-22, Beloved, the works of Michael Crichton, John le Carré, Ray Bradbury, Doris Lessing, and Robert Carroll, among others. His career began at Simon & Schuster in the 1950s, continued at Alfred A. Knopf, where he served as president and editor-in-chief before he succeeded William Shawn as editor of The New Yorker magazine in the late 1980s. Today, Gottlieb is still working closely with historian Robert Caro to complete the fifth volume in his monumental biography of President Lyndon Johnson. And always, always, Gottlieb's always reading.
I read everywhere and all the time. And if there isn't a book to read, I'll read a magazine. If there isn't a magazine, I'll read a newspaper. If there isn't a newspaper, I'll read, I don't know, the back of a cereal box.
Are you one of these folks who, when you travel, there's a separate suitcase full of books, or do you just do one at a time?
Well, first of all, there's the preparation. Like if I'm going away for 3 weeks, because I live in various places. So the question starts in my mind, what am I taking with me? I'm not thinking about clothes, or, which I don't have many, and I've got them in various places anyway. No, no, it's what books am I going to read that month? And if I'm going, say, to Paris, where I happen to have an apartment, I know the bookstores where I can buy books if anything bad happens to the books I brought with me, like I've already finished them. And then there's my Kindle. So if you've got your Kindle stacked with the great writers whom you admire of the past, you're really secure. If you have all of Balzac and all of Henry James and all of Dickens, you know, at a fingertip distance, you're not going to languish.
No.
But
no.
I do think
you don't mind being stuck on the tarmac.
Oh no. As long as it's on the ground. I'd much rather be on the tarmac than in the air.
Right. Oh, that's so great. There are so many books I want to ask you about, but we don't have time for that at all. Let's begin with Caro and the Johnson project. I remember when that first volume was published and I was a young fellow out in Oregon, and I read it, you know, in my backyard. I thought to myself, I was just beginning in journalism. I said to myself, my God, I hope he hangs on to finish the story.
And we're still hoping.
What's that been like, the saga of, I mean, and you go back to the Robert Moses book.
Absolutely. No, I've been his only editor.
Yeah.
The Johnson books, for me, are fascinating about Johnson, about whom I did not know very much before we began this saga, this not-yet-ended saga. But also he takes us through various aspects of America that I didn't understand. Even, for instance, the Senate book, Master of the Senate.
Which I loved.
You know, we all think we know what the Senate's like, but we don't. And he takes a long time to explain the Senate, its history, and its workings. See, he likes to show how things work and therefore how power is actually deployed, except not the way we think it may be. So that's that book. And in the last volume about the assassination and the sequence that followed it, it's about the transition of power in America. How does that work? You know, so that you learn from each book. In the second book about Texas, it's about Texas politics, but it's about local politics. Mm. And you begin to understand how it happens. And because Johnson did so many different things, you trace a huge amount, not just of American history, but about how America works. So the books are very revealing on many, many levels.
How's he doing on the last one?
Working.
Yeah.
Don't ask me.
Don't ask me. When he finished Power Broker about Robert Moses, first of all, did he tell you things about Robert Moses that you had no idea about?
Well, I had no idea about Robert Moses, really? Although I'm a New York kid,
right,
and grew up in what was then really Robert Moses' city.
Right.
He was just to me a name and a function. And I thought, who is, when I first heard of this project, who's going to want to read a book about Robert Moses? I certainly didn't. But by the time I had read 2 pages of the 4 billion pages that the manuscript amounted to, I wanted to know everything about him, and I ended up knowing everything about him.
God, that's amazing. One of my favorite books of yours is Barbara Tuchman's Distant Mirror.
That's a wonderful book, isn't it?
It is so amazing how she just transports you back in time. And again, like Caro, she chooses a particular character to give you a window, distant mirror, on a time of history.
And it's not accidental that Barbara was a kind of hero of Bob Caro's.
Is that right?
Even before he knew her, he immensely admired her work. And I won't say he modeled himself on her, because he didn't model himself on anyone. But she certainly was someone very much in his mind as an historian to admire and try to achieve a comparable body of work.
Mm. You did a great favor for me when you were editor of The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was you, maybe not, but I don't know how much a hand you had in this. I was based in Jerusalem for National Public Radio, and there's a time when, you know, you're a Middle East correspondent, when you're in a far-flung place where you just feel so separated from the world and everyone around you. It doesn't matter where you are. You could be Africa, wherever your assignment is. At a certain point, you just get so exasperated by all the – why can't you people be normal? There's just nothing here appealing about these problems and you know, that you have to report on. And somebody sent me this – it must have been a 15,000-word New Yorker piece about bats.
Oh, yes. I was very responsible for that.
It saved my life. Yeah. I mean, it brought me back from the brink. It was an amazing story.
Well, that was one of the great things about The New Yorker in those days, not invented by me, but I just – took over that tradition, which was the subject didn't have to be hot. The subject had to be interesting. And then you had to have a writer who was fascinated and who plunged himself or herself into the subject. And that's what happened with Diane Ackerman in that piece.
That was Diane Ackerman, of course.
That was her first piece for the magazine.
Of course. I can still remember lines.
And you know, it changed a lot, apparently, I'm told, that when that – after that piece came out, it changed the way people considered bats and their place in the ecology or whatever you want to call it. So the Bat Association of America, if there was such a thing, was very, very gratified by this.
You've been responsible for a lot of memoirs of – hugely important or notable people, ranging from Bill Clinton, Katharine Graham, to Katharine Hepburn.
Right.
And the experiences you had with Clinton, Graham, and Hepburn could not be more different. Would you care to describe the ways in which you approach a project like that?
Well, I don't approach it. I just get into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're a good editor – you immediately sense whether you're in tune with the person you're going to work with, particularly for something as important and large as Bill Clinton's book. If he and I had not got along, we couldn't possibly have pulled it off. Luckily, from almost the first moment, we did, and we had a great time. But he was very easy to work with because he's a worker, and he's smart and quick. And from my point of view, also a night owl, because I am one too. So we could talk at 1 a.m. He turned stuff around as fast as I turned stuff around. And he was funny, loose, unself-protecting. Because I'd said to him at the very start, look, you know, this is embarrassing, but I have to say to you before you even start, you're going to have to deal with the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal. So he said, of course I understand that, no problem. The best thing he did for me at the very beginning was tell me to read his mother's book. Hmm. I didn't know His mother had written a book. And he was so right. It was wonderful because she was a good old gal. And she told it the way it was. And one of the wonderful things about Clinton that I came upon was that book is not tactful. And years later, she died just before it was published. Mm. But I ran into the, speaking to the guy who was the collaborator, whom I hadn't met before. It was something else we were talking about. And I asked him about her, and he thought she was fabulous. But he said, when the book was done, I had to submit the manuscript to the president because he was her literary executor. So he sent it, and within 48 hours, maybe less, he got a direct call from Bill saying, it's wonderful, fine, no problem, go ahead. And he asked him, he said, doesn't this bother you? Because he expected there would be pushback. And the president said, Bill said, this is her book, not my book. I wanted it out there exactly the way she wanted it. And had she lived to promote that book, there would have been a lot out there on the street that might have been a problem for him. But that was not what he was like.
Of the three books, the Katharine Hepburn, the Clinton, and the Katharine Graham, the Graham, by far, is the favorite of mine. That story.
It's a wonderful book.
Oh, my. She just has such a great story to tell as a young woman, and then, of course, as someone who's, you know, in a difficult marriage, and then she's in an amazing
book. See, my luck with her was, and maybe with Bill Clinton, too, is before Bill Clinton, I had never met a politician, let alone a president. And before Kay Graham, I had never really done a book about Washington. I'm not a Washington person. So for me, I'd met Kay years before at a party.
Truman Capote party?
No. Mm. I can't even remember for whom it was. And I don't go to many, but she was there and we got along fabulously. So to me, she was a very nice woman with an interesting background, and I wanted to work with her. I didn't know that she was the empress of all she surveyed. Mm. So she didn't have that effect on me, nor did Bill. I mean, he was a president I had admired, but that was it. Mm-hmm. To me, being the president of the United States was not as psychically imposing as being the greatest ballerina in the world, since my other life has to do with dance. Mm-hmm. So it's easier that way. You're not in awe. You know, because there has to be a balance between the two parties, the editor and the writer. I mean, it's the writer's book. The writer is the important one. But if you're going to be helpful, you have to have a confidence of your own.
Why was Katharine Hepburn so angry that you went to The New Yorker?
Because she felt everything revolved around herself. It was a surprise to her. It was a sort of surprise to me, because it happened very, very fast. I mean, it was really within a week that Cy Newhouse and William Shawn fell apart. Mm-hmm. A story that I was very happy to be able to tell in this book, because nobody, as far as I know, has spoke to both of them about what happened except myself. Mm. And I was happy that that happened, because neither one was a villain or a victim. It was a true non-meeting of minds. Shawn said one thing that he thought he knew what he was saying. Newhouse heard another thing, and he was convinced that he was right. So they misheard each other, but they were born to mishear each other. You know, these were not two guys who should have been involved with each other at all. Hepburn was very domineering. We both lived on these Turtle Bay Gardens. Our houses are almost back to back. So we were neighbors, as well as, I don't want to say collaborators, because an editor is not a collaborator. He's a serviceman. He's doing a service job, and he's a handyman. But we sort of knew each other, and she was fine to work with, very hard worker, of course, which for me goes a long way. But she was very charming. She wanted what she wanted. And like many people of her kind, she was perfectly happy to get what she wanted through charm, and which she had, of course, and persuasion. But if she didn't have what she wanted, she could be a bitch on wheels. And why not? You know, many of us can be a bitch on wheels. Yeah. I try not to be, and I assume you do too. So we got along very, very well. as an editorial relationship. But suddenly she read on the front page of the New York Times that her editor and publisher was gone, more or less, although I wasn't yet gone. So she stormed into my office demanding an explanation and not very eager to hear one. But when I told her the story and that I was not abandoning her because I would be working with her only from a different office doing the same thing, she calmed down. It was an eruption, but she was an eruptor.
Mm. The story that surprised me the most in this book was that you had the opportunity to publish Confederacy of Dunces.
Why would that surprise you?
I guess I'm so used to thinking of your legendary instincts that you would be the person who would see on the page that this was the magic book. And I sort of remembered the story, but I would have thought that – I don't know. I mean – I guess if it was presented to me, I would have thought it was kind of a strange story myself and would have passed on it.
But, no, that's not what happened. He sent me a manuscript out of the blue because he had read a book I had edited and published that he was crazy about.
Which one?
Bruce J. Friedman's Stern. And I read this manuscript and I was really struck by the talent and the energy and the fun of it. But it was a mess.
Mm.
And it was a mess – not just structurally, but it didn't have control of itself. He didn't really know what he was doing, although he did it with tremendous gusto and style, if you like that style. So we started a correspondence, and for about 2 years that continued. So I certainly recognized the talent such as it was, and I tried to steer him and guide him, and he worked very hard and was back and forth. During that period, I sensed that he was fraying, and he got more and more, I would say, both distressed and distressing, and more so demanding and upset and confused by my standards. And I didn't feel that he was working on the book, more or less, I guess, along the lines I was suggesting. I didn't feel it was getting there.
Hmm.
Finally, I was out of town. He turned up in our offices, uninvited, etc., and made scenes. And it was clear to me that I did not want to continue in this relationship. There was no formal relationship between us. So I just told him, I just don't think this is going to work out between us. We both walked away.
Sad story, though.
It is a sad story. And when he committed suicide some years later, his awful, demented mother believed or asserted publicly that I, as part of a kind of East Coast Jewish elite, had driven him to suicide. So he was unstable. She was more unstable. So that was that. Then it had its miraculous publication and success. I never read what was published at that point. But when I was writing this book, I decided I better read it, see what I think. Was I crazy? What did I think now? So I read it. It all came back to me. And I had exactly the same reaction. Mm. All this talent, all this energy, but a sophomoric approach to life, a humor that was out of control. And finally, I would have turned it down again.
Mm.
So at least I'm consistent, although perhaps foolish.
Toni Morrison,
mm-hmm.
She carries herself as very much a voice of history in America, but you just looked at it as a story.
Well, Toni was working at Random House as an editor when I was there running Knopf, which is part of Random House. So we knew each other and mm-hmm. liked each other. Her first book, The Bluest Eye, was published by another publisher. And was wonderful, was hailed as a very deeply talented and marvelous book, which it was. And then we all decided, you know, she's a Random House person. She should be published by Random House. But she couldn't be published by her part, which was the Random House trade division. Mm-hmm. So Knopf was the obvious alternative, and we knew and liked each other. You know, Toni and I are exactly the same age, with the same reading background. So we melted or melted or whatever the word should be. So with her second book, Sula, I started to edit her, and I'm still editing her. She sent me 40, 50 pages the other day of her newest book.
Worst argument you ever had with Toni Morrison?
I never had an argument with Toni. The only thing we ever disagree about is commas. And
you want more? She wants less?
I want commas where they belong. She doesn't always. And I finally figured out why. Because, you know, you've heard Toni speak. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever heard her read. Mm-hmm. She's an amazing person reading and speaking. And she hears it. When she's reading, and I assume when she's writing, she hears what she's saying. Well, if you hear it, you don't need punctuation because it's punctuated in your head. But if you're reading it without the benefit of her voice, sometimes it's a stopper. Wait a minute. Oh, I see. I see what she means. So it's a joke between us. It's just one of our jokes. And I think she says we sort of – we give each other one. You can have this one, but you can't have that one.
You helped give birth to the Gloria Vanderbilt story.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of the continuation of that story with Anderson Cooper's notoriety?
I think it's terrific. You know, Gloria is an amazing person. I didn't know her before one day. She called me at my office and said, would you consider editing my book? This was her first memoir, Once Upon a Time. And I had to tell her that I had edited and published the book about her called Little Gloria Happy at Last by Barbara Goldsmith, which was a huge bestseller and which I had heard that she didn't like. And she said, no, I know that. It's true I didn't like it, but it's nothing to do with it. I just would like you as my editor. So I read her pages and I loved them. And the thing about Gloria was, you know, she's so striking and so poised and you think that she's going to be haughty or grand or difficult. Not at all. As a worker, not at all. Her focus is on the job. And she'll listen to anything. She'll respond in her way to anything. There was never a moment's problem between us. And we went on to work together. I liked her very much because I respected her work ethos. And I liked her personally because she's very, very likable and smart.
Do you see that ethos in Anderson?
I don't know him, right. But I sense it in him, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I thought that book was very, very interesting and deserved its success.
Do you covet any books that made it that you would have loved to have edited?
War and Peace. But I don't think he was editable.
Apparently not.
Apparently not. No, I don't think that way. You know, there's enough to do.
Right.
It's not that I need more. I regret the few really terrific books that for one reason or another I didn't do.
Like which ones?
I could have done, John Fowle's first book. Mm. I just blanked its name. You know, other things. But look, they come and they go.
Right.
And for every writer whom you don't take on, whom someone else has a big success with, there's a writer whom someone else didn't have a success with and you take on and the chemistry is right or the moment is right and it works. No, I don't live in regret. That's not my style.
You speak of it all as like a garden, that you're nurturing the broad sense of writing, growing up and being harvested. And
well, I'd like to think of it that way.
You have a garden, right?
Do I have a garden?
You did have a garden. You shared a garden with Catherine Hepburn.
Well, that's in the back of our houses. Yeah. My wife has a garden up in our country house. But I'm not an outdoors person. My childhood was punctuated by events such as my parents when I was 11 or 12 or whatever. Since I did absolutely nothing apart from school, then sit in my room and read and listen to the radio, which is what we did in those days because there was no television. They wanted me out of doors. So it was determined that I had to be out of doors an hour every afternoon after school. And we lived half a block from Central Park, but that was not for me. So I would stand.
That was the wilderness to you.
That was the wilderness.
Yeah.
So I would stand next to the doorman playing with my yo-yo for an hour. And then I would go upstairs to Jack Armstrong, All American Boy.
So I gather you don't have a gym membership.
No, I don't.
Do you have a favorite chair?
I have a big chair in the big room I work in, but I can work anywhere.
You know, there's so much that you've done that's just wonderful history, just deep, thoughtful nonfiction and fiction. And then, for my taste, there's miraculous books like Catch-22, mm-hmm. where for me, reading that book was, I can't believe I'm experiencing this as I'm reading it. Did you have that feeling just coming upon the manuscript, or did it have to be, you know, whacked into shape?
Well, as with many books, I came into contact with it in pieces because I was reading it long before it was finished. It was a long process. Joe took many years to write it. So between the time I first saw material to the time there was a complete manuscript, it was like 4 or 5 years. Mm. Oh, it had an immense amount of work. We did a great deal of work on it, and on all the books of his I worked on. Joe was, first of all, apart from a great guy, he was an extraordinary editor. Of all the writers I've worked with, he had the best editorial mind.
Really?
There were some others who were good, like John le Carré had a wonderful editorial mind. Others know, like Doris Lessing. She wasn't interested in editing. She was one of my closest friends, but it was irrelevant. She, once it was done, it was done. She wasn't interested. But Joe was not only unbelievably acute about editorial process, but he loved it. And he was egoless. Now, he knew that he had written an important book. He knew it before anyone else knew it, including me. But when dealing with it, absolutely no vanity, ego. We would sit, and I think I wrote this, like two surgeons working on the same patient. You know, this phrase isn't working. Right. What if we do this? No, better here. Then we'd have to do this. Exactly. But we put that there. And that dialogue could have been either of us talking in either role. He was completely clear and fine. Even when at the last moment, almost soon before it went to press, I said to him, you know, there's a chapter in here I've never liked. The tone doesn't work for me with the rest of the book. He said, drop it. That was the discussion.
Wow.
That's what he was like. But that doesn't mean he didn't know what he had achieved.
Did you think that Catch-22 would become part of the language?
See, I don't think that way.
Yeah.
I just do the job that's in front of me.
Does it amaze you that it is part of the language, that everyone...
Well, you know, it doesn't amaze me in this sense. There are certain words or phrases that the language or the world needs. And then they come along and they become embedded in the language. Here's another one. You know, we all say something is Kafkaesque.
Right.
Well, we didn't have that word before. There was a Kafka. But the moment we had it, we needed it. And it's not that everybody who uses it has spent his or her life reading Kafka. It's that we needed that word. We needed that thing to describe something. And Catch-22 worked for that and for us.
Did you argue about the title?
Argue? I never argued with Joe.
Joe, that was the title from the beginning?
No, it was Catch-18.
Right, right, right.
It was Catch-18. And we had to change the number. That was utterly hilarious because as we were approaching publication in 1961, we read Publishers Weekly that Leon Uris, whose novel Exodus had been one of the phenomenal successes of our time, had a new book coming out also about the war called Mila 18. Well, obviously, we couldn't have Leon Uris's Mila 18 coming out the same season as an unknown writer's first book called Catch 18. But the idea of the catch had to be retained, so we needed a new number. So there was a great deal of agitation about what number to pick, and we thought of 11, but that was the time of Ocean's 11, so that was too confusing. We thought of 14. I think Joe came up with that. I didn't like it. And one night I was lying in bed sleepless over this monumental, world-shattering problem, and the number 22 crossed my mind. And I called him in the morning, and I said, I've got it. I've got it. 22. It's even funnier than 18. Well, this, of course, was delusionary because no number is funnier than any other number. but we needed a number, so we settled on that one.
If that's all I'd ever done in my life, I would be the happiest man
in the world.
But that
was 30 seconds lying in bed. What I've done the rest of my life, I would not have been dizzy.
Oh, what's next for you, Mr. Gottlieb, before we dismiss you here from the studio?
What's left for me, work-wise?
Yeah, anything.
Well, I'm still a functioning editor. Yeah. I'm 85, but my mind seems to be working away. I'm still working with Toni Morrison. I'm still working with Bob Caro. Other writers, too, in other fields. I've been writing a great deal, mostly for the New York Review of Books.
Happy about the publishing industry?
Oh, perfectly.
Digital stuff make you crazy?
No, it doesn't make me crazy at all.
You Twitter know, doesn't
bother me. I've been around too long, you know, and I've read too much. Like, in the 1920s, book publishing was going to be dead because of the emergence of the book clubs, the Book of the Month Club. That was going to kill book sales, so that was that. Obviously, it didn't. Then there came the medium is the message.
Right.
And that was the end of reading. Well, I'm still reading. You're still reading. We're all still reading. Then came the chains. Then came
television.
Television was going to stop reading. Now it's the
Internet.
The Internet. It's games. Now it's Amazon that's going to kill publishing. Well, you know, publishing is, to my mind, pretty healthy. People are buying a lot of books and people are reading. I look at my grandkids. They're obsessive readers. Now, that's anecdotal. But still, anecdotes add up. So I have no such fears. For myself, you know, I hope I have a few more years. I like to function. I write. I'll write more. This book came along. I didn't want to write it. I decided I would write it for various reasons. I wrote it. It's over.
We're glad you did.
Well, I'm glad I did because the main reason I wrote it is my daughter, whom I obey in all things, wanted me to write it, mostly so that at some point her twin boys, who are now 13, if they were interested, could read and find out how their grandfather spent his life.
And know what the whole legendary thing is
all
about.
Well, that legend would be long gone. But so, and the publisher wanted me to write it. So I said, okay, I'll do it. So the moment I have an assignment, it's done, because not fulfilling an assignment, not being on time, is beyond my ability to imagine myself being. It would be too shaming and horrible. So I said I'd do it, so I did it. So I'm glad I did it. I'm glad it's finished. I'm glad it's been so well received. But you know what? It's out of my head. I lived it all. I didn't need it to. I don't live in the past. I don't live in the future, which is just as well at my age. So there we are. It's done. People seem to be liking it. I'm delighted.
Who's your editor? Some terrified person who?
Oh, Farrah Straus, Eileen Smith. And then I have friends who read for me. You know, we all help each other out. But I'm my editor. I write by editing. You know, it's there, and then I edit, and I edit, and I edit, and I edit. Still, I need support and like it and enjoy it. See, I love the editorial process. And whether I'm editing you or you're editing me, the process is the same. You're making these decisions based on your ability to read yourself or the other person. So I enjoy that process because it's about language, it's about words, it's about ideas. So I love being. The first time somebody edited me, I remember, I will name no names, he was in absolute mortal terror. Of course, since I'm not scared of me, because I think of myself as a guy who lucked into a wonderful job and was good enough at it to be successful, but I do not see myself as a legend, obviously only an idiot would. I couldn't imagine anyone being afraid of me. Why would anybody be afraid of me? But there it was. But he got over it. And anyone gets over it because, you know, I'm talky, I'm jokey, I'm relaxed, because what's there not to be relaxed about? The fate of the universe is not involved here.
Trump.
Isn't he divine? First of all, he's given us all something to talk about. And it's not so bad to live in trepidation and terror, lest the worst happen, which I do not believe it will. You know, I knew Hillary when I was working with Bill.
Right.
I didn't know her well. But I could see why she would be a good president, now that I look back. Didn't occur to me then, of course. She was organized. She was smart. She was responsive. She knew how to do it. Now, Bill knew how to do it because it was in him. Everything about him came right out, you know. With her, I felt more, she had learned how to do it, but she had learned it well, and she enjoyed knowing it. So it was a different feeling. But I think she'd be a wonderful president. But even if she would be the worst president in the world, she couldn't be a worse president than Donald Trump. So there you are. There's not much choice.
Takes the pressure off her, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Robert Gottlieb, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.